dear brethren and sisters, and our dear young people. In our last class, we moved rather hurriedly through the last few verses, for which I received a small amount of criticism afterwards. And to try and make amends for that, I just want to spend 1 or 2 minutes, and I mean only 1 or 2 minutes, in just reviewing some of the features which were actually in those last few verses. And in defence of myself, I would say that whilst we did move fairly quickly through it, it was a fairly straightforward exhortational section, and the reason I wanted to finish it was because it was based upon the exposition found in the earlier part of the chapter, and it was desirable therefore to try and keep the connection between the two. But I'd like to pick up the relevant point which is going to carry over into our study this evening of Hebrews chapter 4. Probably we could pick it up from about chapter 3 and verses 7 and 8. So there we read, "Wherefore, as the Holy Spirit saith, today, if ye will hear his voice, harden not your hearts, as in the provocation, in the day of temptation in the wilderness." And so there's 2 points come out in that appeal. One is the emphasis on the word today. And that's going to come out again this evening. It's a quotation, as we saw, from Psalm 95. Now, Paul goes back to it 3-4 times. In this particular section. So the emphasis on today, and we're going to have to consider that a little later this evening ourselves, because in view of what we've heard from the current events this evening, today still applies. In fact, it applies more than it's ever applied to any generation. Today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts. Is there a possibility that our generation has more potential for hardening their hearts than any other generation? I believe the answer is yes. And we'll consider that in due course when we come to it. And so there were the 2 points, the emphasis on the fact of it being today, and the other, the appeal not to harden our hearts. Those who did harden their hearts, Yahweh said concerning them in verse 11 of that chapter, "So I swear in my wrath, I swore by myself on oath, they shall not enter into my rest." Hence the words of verse 15, "While it is said, today if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts as in the provocation." So the 3 points that come out of that is the emphasis on the importance of today, the exhortation to harden not your hearts, and the reminder that those who do harden their hearts will not enter into God's rest. Now there's nothing complicated in that, but I'm sure brethren and sisters, all of us would agree that the real powerful issues in the truth are the simple ones. They're the ones that are so simple that very often we tune out to them, we wait for the exciting exposition point, the new deep point to come out, the new point. Whereas in fact, the power of this particular exposition here is this, that we are on the eve of Christ's return. The potential is that despite all of the signs in the world, we're going to harden our hearts. The very affluence of the world, the very precious of society, lead us away from the reality of the truth. And we'll see how these people who are on the very borders of the promised land, you might recall when we did some studies on Deuteronomy a while back, the book of Deuteronomy, all recorded in one day, the last day of Moses' life. Many of the events of that chapter describe what took place in that last year. And there they were standing on the borders of the promised land, and some of the worst things in the 40 years of the wanderings took place as they're standing there with the promised land just over the river. The matter of Baal Peor, one of the worst sins that Israel's ever engaged in. All of those things took place while they're on the borders of the land. Now what about our society? Do we find more worldliness creeping into our midst? Do we find ourselves being drawn away with the ease of society and spending money and time on things which are not profitable? Spending our time with the things of Baal, as Israel did? Well, that's the very thing that is being spoken about here. Because you remember that quote from Psalm 95, which picked up those 2 incidents in the wilderness. The one at the beginning of the wanderings, the other at the end of the wanderings. Massa and Meribah, when they put Yahweh to the test, and there on the borders of the land, some of the worst things that Israel ever committed took place in that period just prior to Israel entering into the rest which God had promised them under Joshua. Brethren and sisters, it is the most powerful lesson we could ever learn, and it's so simple that we can just tune out and wait for something new to come. Now that's how the chapter draws to a conclusion, but it concludes particularly with, as we saw last time, three questions. And those questions are listed in the notes on page 34. And I'm referring you to the notes rather than to the text, because they don't come over all that clearly as questions in the King James Version. They do in some other translations, and I do think that around this area of Hebrews that the New International Version is very, very good. It's not good in everything in the Bible. It wasn't all that good in Romans. But in this area of Hebrews at least, I think it is very good. There were three questions. Verse 16. Who were they who heard and rebelled? Who were the ones that rebelled? Who were the ones that put God to the test? Weren't they the ones that Moses led out of Egypt? So the very ones that were saved out of Egypt, they were the ones that heard the word and rebelled. And so this is the first of the three questions for which Paul demands answers from his readers. The second question, verse 17, with whom was he angry for 40 years? Well, it was with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the desert. And verse 18, to whom did God swear that they would never enter his rest? It was those who disobeyed. So can you see the general deterioration there? God saved them out of Egypt. The ones that he saved out of Egypt were the ones that he destroyed in the wilderness. And who were the ones of whom he said, they will never enter my rest? It was those who disobeyed. Now, why did they disobey? Well, the essence of this whole section is, it's because they didn't believe. It was because of lack of faith. Now, lack of faith, can you get anything simpler? How often, you know, when you've asked your children some question and they don't know the answer to it, so they say the answer's faith, you know? It doesn't matter what the question is, it's faith, because that just seems to cover everything. It's the simplest thing that our children learn from the earliest days. They don't know what it means, perhaps, but that's the essence of salvation. We are saved by faith. And we will be destroyed because of lack of faith. Now, we're talking about the problems in the world. Do we really believe that Christ is coming? If we believe that Christ is coming, then we will be manifesting that belief in a way of life which shows we are desirous of entering into that rest on the principles which Hebrews so beautifully and so powerfully expounds here. It's going to mean also that we're going to have to give up things. And I would suggest, brethren and sisters, that making generalisations, and generalisations aren't always true in the specific sense, that the Christadelphian community, in a general sense, I think could be showing more apathy than it has done for a long time. It gives lip service to the fact that Christ is coming. But we're finding young and old alike engaging in worldly activities which a few years ago were not engaged in. And it would apply to this ecclesia as much as to anywhere else. It's a tragedy. Not only can these people destroy themselves, they can take others down with them. And we would appeal to all, young and old alike, to very seriously consider the influence that they can have on others as standards drop, as we stand on the borders of the promised land, and the activities of Baal, Peor and other similar activities can be found in our own midst, where people just don't believe that Christ is about to return. They can talk about it, they can know it, they can hear it, and they don't believe it. Could we make our appeal any more pointed than that? Well, brethren and sisters, that's how chapter 3 ends up. So they could not enter in because of unbelief. Just to briefly review again where this section stands in relation to the book of Hebrews as a whole. We know, of course, how that in Hebrews there are the comparisons made between the law and Christ, and how that everything in Christ is better than what it was under the law of Moses. Well, in this section, which constitutes chapters 3 and 4, we're contrasting the son and the future inheritance with the inheritance that the children of Israel obtained under Moses and Joshua. Now, chapter 3 deals essentially with the comparison between Christ and Moses. When we come to chapter 4, the contrast is between Jesus and Joshua. And for those who didn't pick up the fact that in verse 8 we have the word Jesus there, but of course it's really Joshua, because Jesus and Joshua are the same, Joshua being the Hebrew and Jesus being the Greek, we are comparing two men who even have the same names. And this evening it is my intention to merely cover verses 1 to 11, which point out to us that the Son will lead us into a rest greater than that under Joshua, and God willing, reserved for our next class, verses 12 to 16, which is the exhortation that comes out of it. The narrative this evening, from verses 1 to 11, if I make a statement that sounds critical of Paul, you'll understand it's not, won't you? I find it rather laboured. Now, that's not meant to be critical. In other words, what we're saying is that if you want me to summarise what he says in verses 1 to 11, I could do it in less than 30 seconds without any real difficulty at all. And it's simply this, that the children of Israel under Joshua did not receive the rest that God had promised to the people of God. That rest will come in the millennium. That's what it's all about. But he engages in a line of reasoning which is not all that easy to follow, and it's made a little bit harder by the King James Version, and hopefully made easier by our paraphrase. Hopefully made easier by our paraphrase, which we'll come to towards the end of the night. But there are two very powerful exhortations, and these two exhortations are contained in the beginning and the end of that section which we're looking at this evening. If you've got your notes there, page 35, you'll see in the middle of the page there a series of expressions all starting with the words, "let us." Now, we've mentioned from time to time that there are certain key words and certain key expressions in the book of Hebrews. And tonight we're introduced to the first occurrence of the phrase, "let us." And you'll notice there's one of them in chapter 4, verse 1, which is where we start. And the second one is in chapter 4, verse 11, where, God willing, we finish this evening. So that's going to be our two exhortations for this evening. The verses in between will be the narrative that links the two verses together. I intend to spend a reasonable amount of time on verse 1, and if you think that we've got pretty close to finishing time and we're still on verse 1, don't worry, because really the section in between is fairly simple narrative, which I think our paraphrase will help us with, and then we will consider the second "let us" there in verse 11. Before we do that, though, just as a matter of exposition as such, notice an overview of those expressions there found in the middle of the page. The first one is in chapter 4, verse 1, "let us therefore fear." In verse 11, we've got the expression, "let us labour therefore to enter into that rest." And they are the two that we will consider in detail this evening. Some of the others, "let us hold fast our profession" in verse 14, and "let us therefore come boldly under the throne of grace" in verse 16. So we've got four of these "let us"s in chapter 4. We get one in chapter 6, "let us go on to perfection." Here were people that were living on the milk. Nothing wrong with the milk of the word, but they were living on the work they'd done years ago. They were living on platitudes. They weren't engaging in Bible study by which their knowledge was becoming mature. Then we jump over to chapter 10 with a series in verses 22, 23 and 24. "Let us draw near with a true heart in faith. Let us hold fast the profession of our hope, and let us consider one another to provoke unto love." And there in those three verses we have faith, hope and love. Obviously we can see the connection with Corinthians. And for those who may not be aware of it, verse 23 doesn't say hope in the King James Bible, but it should be hope. So we've got faith, hope and love. Three appeals there. Then we go over to chapter 12, verse 1, "let us lay aside every weight." Same verse, "let us run with patience." Verse 28, "let us have grace." And then the final appeal, to identify with the sacrifice of the Lord Jesus Christ, chapter 13, verses 13 and 15, "let us go forth therefore unto him, and let us offer the sacrifice of praise."
So if anybody thinks that the book of Hebrews is a deep, difficult, expository book, look at those simple appeals. So the exposition becomes the basis of these very important appeals. And we want to move, therefore, onto our first appeal for tonight, and the first appeal from Hebrews, let us fear. Let us fear. Let us fear lest the promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. Seems a little bit grammatically strange, but that's only by the way. He says, let us fear lest the promise being left us of entering in, any of you should seem to come short of it. Paul was prepared to identify himself with that community, but as far as the coming short was concerned, there was no way in which the Apostle Paul could identify with the problem they had, which was the problem of reverting to Judaism. Therefore, it was those that were going to come short of it, them out there, the you that were going to come short of it, certainly not the Apostle Paul. But nevertheless, he identifies himself with this appeal and with this promise of entering in. So I'd like to have a look, first of all, at the word fear. The notes on the bottom of page 35 and over to the top of page 36 cover this fairly extensively, but I'll pick out the highlights on this overhead transparency. I suppose the subject of the word fear is one that often comes up for discussion as to whether or not it's right to fear God. And people often say, well, depends what you mean by the word fear. Well, maybe not everybody's aware of the fact that there are different words for fear in the New Testament. Now, that doesn't solve our problem totally, but it does go a fair way towards it. There are really only three words for fear. Our notes towards the bottom of page 35 say there are essentially three Greek words translated as fear. And somebody said to me, what do you mean there are essentially three? Are there three or are there more than three? Essentially always seems to me to mean that it's not three, it's something a bit different. To which I replied to the questioner, well, there are only three words, the words there that look like delia, eulabia and phobos, but there are some cognate forms of the word. Now, we've come across this word cognate before, haven't we? All we're saying is that you might have a word that is a noun. The same word can come over as a verb or an adjective. To all intents and purposes, it's the same word. But if someone wants to be technical, it's not the same word. It's a different grammatical form of it. So what I'm saying is that there are some cognate forms of it, and I'm including all of those in our analysis, but essentially there are only three different words. Now, I think the questioner tuned out by that stage and just went on and typed it anyway. Here are the three words. The first word is the word delia, and these are all the occurrences of it, the total occurrences of the word, or its cognate. In other words, what we are saying is the actual word delia, translated fear, only occurs once in the Bible, and that's in the 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. But these other occurrences here are another grammatical form, so to all intents and purposes it is, quote, essentially, end of quote, the same word. This word means cowardice or timidity and is always used in a bad sense. So this is the word that means to be afraid of something. Let's just look at the 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 7. Says, for God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. That's one of those verses that could well go up on a board, couldn't it, or a placard. It's an excellent verse, isn't it? God has not given us the spirit of fear. We do know that in other parts of the Bible we're told to fear God and things like that. Obviously not this word. So God has not given us the spirit of cowardice or timidity. That's totally opposed to the things of the truth. So there is fear in a bad sense. Similar words in John chapter 14 and verse 27. John 14 verse 27.
Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. And the word afraid there is a cognate word. You can see it's just in a different grammatical form. So he's telling us then that the peace that he gives us is adequate to cover all timidity or cowardice. So we shouldn't be afraid of anybody who is opposed to the truth. Doesn't matter if Andrew's prediction of Spanish Inquisitions and that starting up again, as he read from those comments and things of that nature, we have nothing to be afraid of. Our ultimate salvation is assured if we believe. So there's our word, afraid. Do not be afraid. That's the sort of fear which is bad. And quickly looking at the other ones, Matthew chapter 8 verse 26. Remember the disciples here in the midst of this storm, and Matthew 8 verse 26 says, "And he saith unto them, Why are ye fearful?" Well, why were they fearful? Who didn't know the answer before they read on? "O ye of little faith." That's why they were fearful, because they didn't believe. It's going to become one of those circuitous reasoning forms of argument tonight. If you don't believe, then you're going to be afraid. It's as simple as that. So they didn't believe, they had little faith, and therefore they were afraid. Mark chapter 4 verse 40. Similar incident. "And he said unto them, Why are ye so fearful? How is it that ye have no faith?" Now of course Matthew says little faith. Now I won't go into the reasons why Matthew says that, except that that is typical of Matthew's line of expression. It's, he who is least will become the greatest, he who is the greatest will become the least. These sorts of expressions. So little faith, in Matthew's reasoning, really means you've got no faith. And Mark spells that out quite clearly. You have no faith, therefore you are afraid. And we finish it up with a very sober warning in Revelation chapter 21 and verse 8, where it lists off the characteristics of those who have no part in the New Jerusalem. And the very first of that list of negative descriptions, of the sort of things that should not apply in the life of the believer, Revelation 21 verse 8, the first one was fearful. "But the fearful and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone." And look at dreadful things like, working backwards, liars, idolaters, sorcerers, whoremongers, murderers, abominable. And he says the fearful and unbelieving are just as bad as the rest of those. No place in the kingdom. So there's our analysis of that word with its cognates, and that's all of the occurrences of it. So yes, fear is a bad thing in the sense of the word delia. Any comments so far on that or anything else? Well, we move on to the second one, which is a word, eulabia. It literally means to be cautious. That's sort of the literal meaning. And there is one occasion where you could really say it means just that, and it's the one down here. I think it's the Acts 23 verse 10 one. It literally means to be cautious, but it can therefore also by extension mean reverence or godly fear. The note at the bottom of page 35 spells it out. It says it means to be cautious, by extension can mean reverence or godly fear, and is predominantly used in a good sense. So it's predominantly a good word. The actual word eulabia only occurs twice, and both occurrences are in Hebrews. We noticed none of the occurrences of delia were in Hebrews. Both of the occurrences of the word eulabia are in Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 5 verse 7. Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 7, speaking of the Lord as the antitype of Melchizedek, it says of him that who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard in that he feared. Now, he wasn't heard because he was afraid of God, because he was timid, because he was a coward. Of course it wasn't. The translation in chapter 12 and verse 28 probably gives us a better idea of it, because although it's the same word, on this occasion the translators saw fit to add in the word godly. And so in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 28 it says, "Wherefore we, receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear." It's the same word, but this time they put godly in. So the expression godly fear is the way in which they've translated this word eulabia. So it's a good word. It has the idea of reverence and respect. And whilst the word cautious might seem to not go quite far enough, that is really the root of the word. Let's notice a couple of other occurrences of the cognates of eulabia. And once again, I've given you all of the references, all of the occurrences of these words in the New Testament. Still in Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 11 verse 7. It was Noah, wasn't it? It was Noah who by faith, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear. He was not afraid. He was not timid. He was not a coward. But he moved cautiously, if you like. And again, cautiously doesn't quite go far enough. But he moved, circumspectly. He determined what had to be done. And it was out of a reverence for God that he did it. He believed God. As a result of his belief, he moved with a godly fear, and he prepared the ark and he saved his house, etc. Just looking quickly at the other references, which don't have any bearing on Hebrews, but which give us an idea of the meaning of the word. It's been translated as devout a few times. And there in Luke chapter 2, just taking them in the order as they occur in the New Testament, in Luke chapter 2 and verse 25... it says there that, "Behold, there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon, and the same man was just and devout, waiting for the consolation of Israel." And the word devout grammatical form of the word is this same word eulabia. He had this godly fear. In Acts chapter 2 verse 5 and Acts chapter 8 verse 2 we again have the same word, and also translated as devout, but we might as well look them all up because there's not all that many. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 5, speaking of the day of Pentecost, that there were dwelling at Jerusalem Jews, devout men. So these were people who had a godly fear, a reverence of God. Could have been translated by the word fear if the translators had wanted to do so. Chapter 8 verse 2 is a similar one. And it says there that devout men carried Stephen to his burial. Now, in our notes we say that the word is predominantly used in a good sense. And you might say, well, everything up till now has been a good sense and we've only got one reference to go. Well, the one in Acts chapter 23 verse 10 isn't exactly used in a bad sense, but it doesn't have that godly connotation. And that's where we see now the idea of perhaps caution coming through. And perhaps if we read the reference, you'll see what we mean by that. In Acts chapter 23... at verse 10, that when there arose a great dissension, the chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled in pieces of them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force. So in this case, it's got nothing at all to do with godly fear. So you see, we can't make a blanket statement and say eulabia means godly fear, although it does in the context of the truth. So that's why I put the full meaning up there. It really means to be cautious. Now, you see, this man, he was a bit worried. He was apprehensive. He was cautious. And he says, oh, look, what's going to happen? Paul might be torn in pieces. Now, extend that into the spiritual realm like we have in the other quotes, and that sort of caution becomes an attitude towards God, which is an attitude of reverence and, if you like, godly fear, if you want to use it. So those two words then stand out quite distinctly. Delia bad, eulabia good, would be a generalisation which is essentially true. Well, that brings us to the word that we've actually got in Hebrews chapter 4. It's the word phobos. This is the word which is commonly translated as fear, and it's not quite as simple as the other two, because it's sometimes used in the sense of fear or dread or terror, but it's more often used in a good sense. And I think the context will normally tell us. But let's just take two examples. For example, we've got there Romans 8 verse 15. Romans 8 verse 15 says, "For you have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear." So you see, it's bad there, isn't it? He said, you're not going back to the spirit of bondage that had under the law, because the law engendered fear. It made you afraid. So the word phobos there really means to be afraid. It's a bad thing. And the other quote which we would know quite well, which is the one in the first epistle of John chapter 4 verse 18, where John contrasts fear and love. And once again it becomes obvious that the sort of fear there is not a good one, although it's this word phobos, which can be good in some contexts. 1st of John chapter 4. Yes, it is, and that's generally bad, isn't it? Can you think of any good phobias? No, I can't. Oh, no, not necessarily. You get different phobia. You get claustrophobia, which is a fear of being closed. You get agoraphobia. I don't know what that means. Open spaces. Well, it's the opposite, doesn't it? And all sorts of other words, can't you? So phobia I would be 100% certain comes from that Greek word phobos, which means a fear. But I can't think of it being used in English in a good sense. Anyone? Any good phobias in English? Alright, well, the comment from 1st of John chapter 4 verse 18 is that there is no phobia, phobos, in love. But perfect love casts out phobos. So obviously the word phobos there is being used in a bad sense. However, as our note says, more often it is used in a good sense, and we've got a list of quotes there. But I'd like to read directly from our printed notes, because we have some quotes from some authorities which I think are very helpful indeed. And I'd like to take the note exactly as it stands at the top of page 36. Phobos is the most commonly used word and is stated to be, quote, a middle term, sometimes used in a bad sense, but more often in a good sense, and lies indifferently between the previous two. That's a comment from a book called Synonyms of the New Testament, and they make the comment that it lies, he says, indifferently between these two. In other words, it can go sort of one way or the other. In Vine's Expository Dictionary of New Testament Words, he says it has two meanings. A, it can mean fear, dread, terror, and Vine claims that it is always used with this significance in the four Gospels, and that appears to be true. On the other hand, and this is the one that we're interested in, it can mean a reverential fear of God as a controlling motive of the life. Take that slowly. A reverential fear of God as a controlling motive of the life in matters spiritual and moral. Not a mere fear of God's power and righteous retribution, but a wholesome dread of displeasing him. That's good, isn't it? That's what our fear is. A dread of displeasing him. A fear which banishes the terror
that shrinks from his presence, and which influences the disposition and attitude of one whose circumstances are guided by trusting God. So he says that this fear is a wholesome dread of displeasing God, and it is a fear which banishes terror, the terror that would shrink from his presence. You know, I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself, says Adam. Fear, shame and concealment were expressly avowed, says Brother Thomas in Helpers Israel. And it's Brother Thomas who says, and the quote's at the bottom of the notes there and at the bottom of our transparency, on page 145 of Helpers Israel, the righteous man's fear of God is the fear of offending one he loves. And that's exactly what Vine is saying. You know, I remember reading that many times in Helpers Israel. I thought, well, that's a very nice comment, but I don't know that you could say that's what the word fear actually means. Well, obviously, Brother Thomas, as usual, knew more than I did. And that, in fact, is the way in which the Greek authorities would see that word in some contexts. So it's got the possibility of being bad or of good. But looking at that good one, and that's the important one, the righteous man's fear of God is the fear of offending one he loves. So when we talk about fearing God, we must never, and I'm prepared to say never, in the strongest possible terms, identify it with Delia. We must never be afraid of God. If we are, then we simply prove that we don't believe him. We are being Judaizers. We are trying to obtain salvation by works of flesh or whatever. There is no way in which that word must apply to our attitude to God. We must not be cowardly towards him. We must not have a timidity towards him. But we can have this reverential respect. And the fear we would have is the fear of offending one that we love. Or, as Vine says, a wholesome dread of displeasing God. And so we've got a list of quotes there, such as Acts chapter 9 verse 31, Romans chapter 3 verse 18, Ephesians chapter 6 verse 5, Philippians 2 verse 12, and 1 Peter 1 verse 17, all of which use this particular word and speak about it as being our attitude towards God. We won't look up the words, but you've got them there, and I think you've picked up, hopefully, the general idea of it. Now, I think that's an important word study, and I did say we would spend a lot of time on verse 1, and that was the point I wanted to look at. Because I think most of us from time to time are a bit worried about this word fear, especially in the context of 1 John 4, where we're told to have confidence in God. See, herein is our love made perfect, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment. And sometimes we'll say, well, I don't think it's right to have that boldness. Well, we say, if you really love God, then you can have that confidence. Oh, yes, but I don't know that I've got perfect love. Well, of course, we haven't got perfect in the English sense of the term love, but we can have that mature love. And so when we go on to read in verse 18, there is no fear in love, the argument may then follow, wrongly so, that because I haven't got perfect love, therefore there's got to be a little bit of fear there. Therefore, it is a right to be afraid of the judgment seat. It is wrong to be afraid of the judgment seat. And I'm sure our studies on the judgment seat at the camp a couple of years ago made us all realise that the judgment seat is not something to be afraid of, but it is something we should look forward to with joyous anticipation, being, as our notes said, the final stage in the refinement of our character. And if we are praying to God daily that he will refine our character, then the judgment seat will be the greatest opportunity to plead for that ultimate refinement. And that's what's embodied in this here. So the fear then is the fear of offending one that we love, and of course we have the idea also of the reverential respect. So in Hebrews we will get the word eulabia in chapter 5 verse 7 and 12 verse 28, and the cognate word in 11 verse 7, and the occurrences of phobos already we've come across it in chapter 2 verse 15, and now here tonight in chapter 4 verse 1. How would you classify it in chapter 4, verse 1? A good fear or a bad fear? I think the first comment I'd have to make is the question isn't well worded. We've been talking about good fear and bad fear, and that's not necessarily the case. But when we say, let us therefore fear, could it possibly mean to be afraid?
Well, if we've got to fear ourselves and be afraid of the fact that our own disbelief is going to keep us out of the kingdom, then maybe, if we look inwardly, we could say it could mean that. If, on the other hand, we're talking about our attitude towards God, it doesn't mean that. So I'll leave it to you as to which way you want to read that, but I would say that there is a sense in which here there is something we've got to be afraid of, and it's not God. It's ourselves. And perhaps the word afraid isn't quite the right word, but we'll pick that up in a moment in our paraphrase, and we'll sort of talk around it a bit. But really what it's telling us is that we've got to be very, very careful, be very, very cautious, and we've got to be extremely concerned, lest the promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. I think that word concern is a good one. I was just surprised that it hadn't occurred, doesn't appear to be in the definitions there, but it does, I think it's a good one. That we have to have a concern about our own unbelief, the potential that we may not enter into that rest. And so Paul immediately then draws the connection between Israel and the wilderness, for unto us was the gospel preached as well as unto them, but the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. We've got another translation there on page 36, halfway down, which does change a few words, and rightly so, and I won't go into all the reasons for it, but just accept the fact that this is a better translation, and you can follow through the notes on these points in other places, such as, for example, the fact that the words faith and belief are cognate words, and also that the word preached really means hearing. For we also have had the gospel preached to us, just as they did, but the message, that is the word or logos, they heard was of no value to them, because of those who heard it did not combine it with faith. I've also put in there a footnote in the NIV, but I don't know that the footnote is necessarily relevant, but I put it there so that you can compare it if you like. But he says there that although they heard it, they did not combine it with faith. And aren't we reminded of Romans 10, verse 17? For faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. And these are the same words being picked up here. Faith comes by hearing, hearing by the word of God. So here are people who heard, but they didn't take that hearing far enough to develop faith. See, faith comes by hearing. Now, we've all heard, but will we allow that hearing to become faith? Well, these people didn't combine their hearing with faith, and so they were unbelievers, and they didn't enter into the rest of God. Verse 3, for we which have believed do enter into rest. As he said, as I have sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter into my rest. I said that the reasoning through here is sometimes a little difficult to follow. And I would think many people would say, well, I can't quite see what he's getting at there. He says, verse 2, we've had the gospel preached to us like they did. They heard it, but they didn't mix their hearing with faith. On the other hand, we have believed, as he said, and then he quotes Psalm 95 again, as I have sworn in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest. What's that got to do with us believing and entering into the rest? What's the connection? And then, just to make it a little bit more complicated, he goes on to say, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. You say, well, I found the first part hard enough, but the latter part doesn't make it any easier, it just seems to make it more complicated. Well, we'll just keep reading for a moment. For he spake in a certain place of the seventh day on this wise, and God did rest the seventh day from all his works. Now he's quoting Genesis 2. You might say, oh, I see, he's sort of saying that Psalm 95 is based upon Genesis 2. Well, yes. But does that make it any easier? Some might say, no, it only makes it harder. Well, that's good, because, you know, if we can get something hard enough, when you really see the answer, you say, well, that was easy after all. Bear in mind, the conclusion we're going to come to is easy, it's just how he gets there. The conclusion is going to be, they didn't enter into the rest that God had in mind when Joshua took them into the land. That will only happen in the kingdom. So that's where he's heading.
So he says, well, verse 5, I told you, Psalm 95, if, and in this place again, if they shall enter into my rest. In other words, they won't enter into my rest. Seeing therefore it remaineth that some must enter in. Now there's the clue. There's the clue to what he's saying earlier. Seeing therefore it remaineth that some must enter therein. What Paul is saying is this, that if Psalm 95 keeps saying they won't enter into my rest, the rebels won't enter into my rest, they're not going to go in, don't you harden your hearts like them, by implication the fact that they didn't go in, but that God is still appealing to you to harden not your hearts, therefore by implication there must still be a future rest available. Actually it's very simple, isn't it? The end result is very, very simple. But Paul deduces this from the fact that some were told they couldn't go in. The fact that they were told they couldn't go in meant that others must obviously be going to be given the chance of getting in. And that's what verse 6 says. Seeing therefore it remaineth that some must enter therein, and they to whom it was first preached entered not in because of unbelief, again he limiteth a certain day, saying in David, today after so long a time, as it is said, today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, then would he not afterward have spoken of another day? There remaineth therefore a rest. And this word becomes a different word. This is the word sabbatismos, which means the keeping of a Sabbath, which links us back to our quote in verse 4, which is the quote from Genesis 2, when God established the Sabbath day. There remaineth therefore a keeping of a Sabbath to the people of God. For he that is entered into his rest, he also hath ceased from his own works, as God did from his. Let us labour therefore to enter into that rest. Now, okay, we move through that very quickly. What I want to do now, I suggest that you keep Hebrews 4 open, but if you like to turn to the paraphrase as well, but try, I think, and read Hebrews 4, and I'll go through the paraphrase and see if this makes the reasoning a little easier, because there's nothing expositionally difficult in those verses. It's just the line of reasoning the Apostle Paul uses to prove that when the Jewish people went into the land under Joshua, it was not the rest that God had in mind. We might as well start from the beginning. So that's verse 1. Therefore, seeing that a promise of entrance into God's rest is still open to us, and my suggestion is you try and follow the text rather than the paraphrase. Seeing that a promise of entrance into God's rest is still open to us, let us learn the lesson from Israel of old and work out our salvation in fear and trembling, making sure that none of you fall from the grace of God. That's verse 1. Verse 2, it is all a matter of faith, faith that comes by hearing. We, like them, have had the good news of deliverance preached in our hearing, but what they heard availed them nothing, because they never took the word unto themselves and believed it. Don't forget what we were saying about half an hour ago. They were the people that were on the borders of the land, and they didn't believe that they were going into that land. Are we any different today? Were the people to whom Paul was writing any different? The potential is that the answer could be, no, we're not any different. Nevertheless, Paul says, picking it up as verse 3, but insofar as we manifest faith, the very sentence that excluded them is to us a guarantee that we shall indeed enter into God's rest. Now there's the key to his argument. I'll read that again. Insofar as we manifest faith, the very sentence that excluded the rebellious is itself to us a guarantee that we shall enter into God's rest. This is apparent in the wording of the psalm previously quoted, where in excluding the rebels from entering the rest, it indicated that the promise was still held open for others to enter. What God said was, I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. In speaking about a rest, it is obvious that he must have in mind something future. For his creative work has been finished since the foundation of the world.
The word rest is significant, for in Genesis 2 verse 2 it says concerning the seventh day, and God did rest the seventh day from all his works. Now this is not the rest from which the rebels were excluded, but it is a type of that greater rest to come. So we note again in Psalm 95 that it says, they shall never enter my rest. This by implication means that there are some who will enter a rest future to the time of creation, future to the time of Joshua, and even future to the time of the psalmist himself. But be reminded, those to whom it was first preached entered not in because of unbelief. And I've just picked up the thought from verse 1 again. Let us therefore fear, because this is the sort of disobedience of which anyone might become guilty. The proof of this lies in the fact that speaking again through David long after Joshua had led Israel into the promised land, God again set a certain day, calling it today, in which the lessons of the wilderness remained valid. Here are the words again. If only you would listen to his voice today and harden not your hearts. That's sort of taken us down to about verse 7. What then is this rest of God? It cannot mean the inheritance of the promised land in the days of Joshua. For if that had been the case, God would not after that time be speaking of another day, another opportunity of attaining his rest. This is clearly implied in the warning of Psalm 95. If only you would listen. No. Manifestly, there is quite another day of opportunity, and that day is the one which is not yet over. We ourselves are living in it. We are living in this today that the apostle keeps bringing up. And the Sabbath rest promised by God to the faithful is yet in the future, even in the millennial Sabbath. This rest is God's own rest. So the order must be the same for us as it was for him. Labour first, rest after. Verse 11, let us then make every effort to enter into that rest, so that no one will be guilty of the same disobedience as Israel and throw away our opportunity as they threw theirs away. Obviously, you'll need to go over it several times, but all I can say is I hope that makes it clearer. It does to me, I suppose, because I wrote it. But it's also interesting in preparing a talk, just as a little bit of a side issue, to prepare a class and then say, now I'm going to write down a paraphrase of all this. I wouldn't like to tell you how long it takes me to write the paraphrase. Many, many hours. Because you start to say, well, what does that verse really mean in the context? You can make out a set of verse-by-verse notes and have all the details there, but in your own mind you haven't got a clear idea of the flow of the argument. So it's an interesting exercise, even if only for the speaker. So we would like to conclude in about 3 or 4 minutes' time by coming then to our second let us. And this, of course, is highlighted on the bottom of page 38. We saw then in commencing our study tonight that Paul says, let us therefore fear. And we examined that word fear in some detail, and we don't need to say anything more about it. So there needs to be a certain concern, there needs to be a caution, there needs to be a reverential respect of that one who has brought us to the land. He's brought us out of Egypt. He has not yet destroyed us in the wilderness. We're on the borders of the land. What have we got to do? Well, one thing is we've got to be concerned. But verse 11 says, let us labour to enter into that rest. That is the sabbatical rest, the 7,000th year of human history. And it's the word labour which becomes the key word. The word labour, the Greek word is noted there, it means to be diligent or to endeavour. So it's not so much the idea of working, although work obviously is associated with it, but it's got the idea of diligence or endeavouring, or even having the idea of a matter of urgency. Without looking the quotes up, in Ephesians 4 verse 3 we have the word as endeavouring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. So it's the word endeavouring in Ephesians 4 verse 3. 2 Timothy 2 verse 15, study
to show thyself approved. I wonder if we've ever used that word slightly out of context. You know, study to show thyself approved. What he's saying is be diligent. Show urgency about indicating to God that you are approved of him. But of course he goes on to say, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. So it does relate to Bible study. We just got to be careful which verse we use to prove it. So the word study there doesn't quite mean study, but the next verse does. So we must give diligence to show ourselves approved. Leave the one from Peter for just a moment. I want to come back to that one. Vine adds that it signifies to hasten, to do a thing, to exert oneself. And here we are on the borders of the promised land. And what are we doing? Organising more leisure time, organising more hobbies, organising more things to do in our spare time, more times to get away, more forms of materialism to take our mind off all our worries. What are we doing? That, I believe, brethren and sisters, is a danger. I mean, we go away, many of us go away overseas and we see other things and we come back and we see things back here too. And you say, well, people are people are people, wherever you go. Most of us are victims of our environment. If it's a good environment, we happen to be about as good as the environment. If it's a bad environment, we happen to be as bad as the environment. And to some extent, it's a sort of a relative type of thing. But what are we really seeing? Are we seeing people doing more Bible marking than ever before? Attending more meetings than ever before? I wouldn't have thought the attendances I'd seen since I've been back have been all that marvellous. And yet we're living in the times, that we've heard about this evening. This word here, labour, means to treat it as a matter of extreme urgency. Let's pick up the quotes from Peter, because in the second of Peter, chapter 1, we've got it occurring three times there. 2 of Peter chapter 1, verse 5, besides this, giving all diligence, there's our word, haste, speed, zeal, urgency. Peter was writing to people who are on the eve of seeing the overthrow of the Jewish Commonwealth. He says you've got to give all attention and diligence and speed to doing this. What? To add to your faith. Virtue, knowledge, temperance, patience, godliness, brotherly kindness, and love. He said you've got to do all of those things. Verse 10. Wherefore the rather, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure. So he says it's a matter of urgency. For if you do these things, you shall never fall. And that, of course, is the very point of Hebrews chapter 4, verse 1. Verse 15. Moreover, I will endeavour that ye may be able after my decease to have these things in remembrance. I'm going to endeavour, says Paul. And the word endeavour there means I'm going to make this a matter of extreme urgency. And in chapter 3 and at verse 14, speaking of the signs of the last days of Judah's commonwealth and its parallel today, 2 of Peter chapter 3 and verse 14 says, wherefore, beloved, seeing that ye look for such things, be diligent that ye may be found of him in peace, without spot and blameless. And so the message is that we are living in exactly the same days as were the children of Israel to whom Paul was referring when he quoted Psalm 95. The same circumstances of the people to whom he was writing, and therefore we have a very direct parallel between Israel at the end of the wilderness wanderings, the last days of Judah's commonwealth, and today. And what is the appeal that goes out to all of those people? Harden not your hearts. Why does he have to say it if they weren't hardening their hearts? What was wrong with the Hebrews? They were going back to the shadow, not to the substance. They'd lost sight of Christ, and the truth had become to them a matter of activity and of works, or maybe even worse than that. We can do no more, and when I say we, I don't mean me. We meaning the scriptures, the Apostle Paul, and I include myself as the one to whom he's appealing. They can do no more than to appeal to us. There is a saying in the world, which is a rather poor expression, but it's very meaningful. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink, they say.
And the truth is like that, isn't it? We can't organise an ecclesia and march them into the kingdom. The scriptures can lead us there. What is required is that we've got to believe that God can lead us there. He brought them out, says the scripture, that he might bring them in. Do we believe that God saved us through the waters of baptism, saved us from Egypt, brought us into the wilderness? Of course we do. Well, God can just as easily bring us into the promised land if we believe. Let's conclude then with a quote from Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 6 and verses 10 to 12. And verse 11 is the verse that's got the word in it. For God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labour of love, which you have showed toward his name, in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister. And we desire that every one of you do show the same diligence. Here's our word again. The same diligence to the full assurance of hope unto the end, that ye be not slothful, but followers of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises. What more can we say, except to repeat the words of the Apostle Paul, that there remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. Let us therefore show diligence as a matter of urgency. With great speed consider our position, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief as Israel in the wilderness.